This podcast from the 2010 Maine Festival of the Book, an annual festival organized by Maine Reads, is brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council.
And this is There Are No News Stories. And a little background information. Nicole Chasson is passionate about real-life heroes, journeys, stories, and the interplay between text and graphics and storytelling. She is the author of the graphic memoir, The Passion of the Hausfrau, and with Anna Sorten, the James Beard Award-nominated Spice. Since 2003, she has chronicled her life in a self-produced comic book, the tri-annually published, I should have asked her how to pronounce this before this, Hausfrau Mutterzink, Mutterzink. All right. Then we've got Deborah Spark is the author. Some of her students are here. Deborah Spark is the author of the novels Good for the Jews, winner of the 2009 Michigan Literary Fiction Award, Coconuts for the Saint, and The Ghost of Bridgetown. She is the editor of the anthology 20 Under 30 Best Stories by America's New Young Writers and a professor at Colby College. Her work has also appeared in Esquire, Plowshares, The New York Times, and Food and Wine. And Elizabeth Searle is the author of Tony and Nancy, the rock opera, which is based on the Harding Kerrigan scandal, and three books of fiction, My Body to You, an Iowa Fiction Prize, A Four-Sided Bed, an ALA Book Award, and Celebrities in Disgrace, which is forthcoming as a short film from Bravo Sierra Productions. She is also at work on a novel based on Bristol Palin, daughter of Sarah Palin. All right, and we're going to start with Nicole, here we go. And I'm just going to let you guys come back and forth, and then there's going to be Q&A afterwards, and of course, there'll be signing later. Here's Nicole.
Thank you. My book, The Passion of the Hausfrau, is based on a very, very, very old story, perhaps the oldest story of them all. And it might also be the most told story ever. At least that's what Joseph Campbell, the great guru of myth and spirituality, thought. Whoops. There he is. It's a story about death and rebirth, about coming into one's own, about facing one's demons, about transformation. It's the story that Joseph Campbell, in his seminal book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, called the monomyth. Here's Joseph Campbell now explaining his monomyth idea. He says, a hero ventures forth from the world of common day into a region of supernatural wonder. Fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow man. This monomyth is so embedded in our culture, we've told this story so many, many times, that it's become the story of stories. It's also called the hero's journey story. It's been told over and over and over again in hundreds and thousands of ways in every culture in the world. It's the story of Osiris, Vishnu, Moses. And since we're in Maine, I want to make sure you understand this is pronounced Buddha and not Buddha. And don't forget King Arthur over there. His monomyth, his hero's journey took place in medieval Europe. The hero's journey story pretty much follows the same structure every time. It goes a little something like this. Up there, number one. The hero begins as an ordinary, everyday kind of person in an ordinary, everyday kind of world. And then we go to two. Soon he receives a call to enter an unknown world of strange powers and events. Three, the hero has to cross a threshold to enter a strange new world, which is the beginning of the hero's transformation from an ordinary person into a hero. Number four, The hero who accepts the call to enter this strange world must face tasks and trials either alone or with assistance, usually from a wizened old person or a crone. These challenges are also sometimes referred to as the road of trials. Number five, the hero must then ultimately face his greatest challenge or fear. Oftentimes, this is depicted in literature and movies as a dragon, a monster, or an evil force. This is the darkest moment in the story. Sometimes the hero literally dies in this phase and then is reborn. In any case, it's through this experience that the hero may achieve a great reward or boon. This reward can either be physical and external, such as a magical elixir that restores life, or a beautiful woman's hand in marriage. That's often what the boon is. It can also be an internal change, such as a revelation. Then we go to number six. The hero must then return to the ordinary world with this boon. He often faces challenges on the return journey. Number seven, he has to cross back over the threshold and re-enter the ordinary world. Eight, once back in the ordinary world, the boon or gift is usually used to improve the world, and even in some cases, to save the world. These stages are always divided into three categories in the hero's journey. It follows the same structure. The departure, sometimes called the separation, which is the first stage. The second stage is called the initiation, and the third stage is called the return. And these stories, like I said, have been around for millennia. Let's take a look at some of them. The hero's journey is the story of Odysseus, the wonderful seafaring fellow in that epic poem by Homer, who, on his road of trials, braves sirens and swine and a cyclops and makes it through Scylla and Charybdis to finally return home to Ithaca and to his loving and loyal wife, Penelope, who's patiently waited for him to return from his adventures. And it's the story of Perseus, that lucky guy who, during the road of trials in his hero's journey, slew not only Medusa, that ugly wench, but also killed the Kraken and saved Andromeda, winning her heart. It's also the story of David. Here he is, David, facing the giant Goliath, who he will slay to free the Israelites. Moving right along, out of the BC era comes Jesus. Here he is being lifted off the cross. This is his abyss, his death, before he's reborn and comes back to change the world. This is perhaps the most famous of all heroes' journeys. Now we're into the Middle Ages. The hero's journey is also the story of Saint George. Here he is facing death, slaying the dragon, and ultimately saving England. And then we'll travel forward into time about 500 years or so, and that takes us right up into the 20th century when a writer from Dublin, Ireland named James Joyce decided he wanted to craft a modern-day hero's journey story based on the ancient Greek hero's journey about Odysseus. James Joyce called his hero's journey Ulysses. Joyce really broke some major ground with this story. It told the hero's journey story of a guy named Leopold Bloom, who was very ordinary. He was a Jew of Hungarian origins living in Dublin, and his adventure consists of doing things like having breakfast, shaving, going to the bathroom, feeding his cat, going to a funeral, doing some work for his job as an advertising representative, and thinking a lot about his unfaithful wife, Molly. In other words, Leopold Bloom is a very ordinary guy, just like us. So you're probably wondering, what about the women? What about the female half of the population? Well, there are hero's journeys starring women. Not as many as there are men's hero's journeys, but there are some. There's Saint Margaret. She's interesting. She was swallowed by a dragon in the Middle Ages, but her faith in God was so strong that she burst out of its stomach and lived to tell the tale. Here's another one of St. Margaret. I really like this one. She's sitting inside a capital letter P from an illuminated manuscript. And here's one of my personal favorites, Dorothy Gale from The Wizard of Oz. Here she is with Toto, who's her helper in her hero's journey. Then there's Ripley from Alien. I love Sigourney Weaver in this role. She's awesome. She has to fight against a horrendous alien monster thing with tentacles and slime and these razor sharp mouths that come out like a mouth comes out of a mouth comes out of a mouth. Saliva's dripping out. It's really gross. And she kills the alien to save her spaceship and the world. So there are hero's journey stories about females, but here's the thing. None of them are mothers. All of the females on hero's journeys are either virgins, prepubescent, or childless. St. Margaret, a virgin. Dorothy, prepubescent. Sergeant Ripley, childless. I got to thinking about this when I was starting to write my book, The Passion of the Hausfrau. I was thinking that maybe it would be fun to write a hero's journey about a mother. So I wanted to see what else was out there, what other hero's journey stories there were about mothers, because after all, it's pretty much a life-changing journey, right? Birthing and raising a child. So I did a Google search to see what other kinds of stories about mothers going on hero's journeys there were, and nothing came up. Nothing. There are no hero's journey stories about mothers. I got to thinking about mothers who appear in hero's journey stories, and a lot of them do, and I realized that they're always the minor characters. They get sick, they die, they put their kids in orphanages, they stay home in the background waiting for their hubbies or their kids to come home for dinner or to save them. Oh wait, speaking of minor characters, there's one mother who is given a chance to go on a hero's journey. I'm thinking of Lot's wife from Genesis. Story goes like this. God gives Lot's wife the opportunity to get the hell out of Sodom with her hubby Lot and their daughter so that they can go have some adventures. But God also tells them that to be successful on their journey, they cannot turn around and look back at their old lives. No matter what, cannot turn around. They must forge ahead bravely so they can get on with their new adventure. Apparently, Lot's wife, and what kind of a name is that anyway, Lot's wife, is wife her last name? Anyway, Lot's wife couldn't stand it. She had to look back, and so she did. And what happened? She turned into a pillar of salt, which kind of ruins any chance at having a hero's journey. Then also, I just need to come clean here and tell you that a couple weeks ago, I was contradicted by a fifth grader who reminded me about Mrs. Incredible from the animated movie a few years ago called The Incredibles. She went on a hero's journey, which is true. But I'm not going to count her because all characters in this movie, every single one, are superheroes. The kid, the husband, the baby, the newborn baby, even the dog, I think there's a dog who's a superhero in this one. If you live in a house full of superheroes and you're a superhero yourself, and even your dog is a superhero and your newborn baby, someone takes the oomph out of your heroism, takes the wind right out of your cape. So anyway, Mrs. Incredible aside, there aren't any mothers who go on hero's journeys in Western literature. And if you can think of one, please let me know, because I'm offering cash money to anyone who can prove me wrong. Anyway, I decided to take the issue into my old hands, and if there wasn't a hero's journey out there about a mother, then I was going to write one myself. So I did. I wrote a hero's journey about a mother, and I made myself the hero. I thought, I want to burst out of a dragon, too, just like St. Margaret. It's so wonderfully dramatic. And that's the best thing about writing your own story. You get to do whatever you want. But anyway, I wanted to tell you a little bit about my hero's journey story, The Passion of the Hausfrau. First of all, my book is a graphic novel. And again, we're talking about there are no new stories. Well, there are also really no new genres. I mean, the graphic novel is sort of a new genre. It's been around for probably 30 years now. But if you think back to illuminated manuscripts, which started in the Middle Ages, they really are graphic novels too. These are some of my favorite graphic novels. And for those of you, sometimes people don't know what graphic novels are. They're just like comic books, basically, that tell one long narrative. This is Mouse by Art Spiegelman. Tells a story of his father's experiences in the Holocaust. Fun Home by Alison Bechdel. Wonderful story about coming out. Epileptic by David B. This is a story about one brother's sort of experiences with his other brother's epilepsy. Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi. This is about a young girl growing up in Iran. And here's some details from medieval illuminated manuscripts. I particularly like this one over here because I love the way the artist used circles to put the art inside. The text runs along the circles, and then the circles, this is the story of Christ's crucifixion and the stories. Medieval illuminated manuscripts had pictures because most people couldn't read in the Middle Ages, and so they could look at the pictures and know what was happening. So I decided to lay my book out like a medieval illuminated manuscript. Here's the first page of my story. It was fun playing with medieval conventions because I got to dress up in armor. And I stole that. I love the circle thing from that other illuminated manuscript, so I stole it for mine. And I like to play on, since it's a story of a woman giving birth and raising children, I made the circles into when a woman's in labor, her cervix dilates up to 10 centimeters. And so I sort of played with that idea. Just a little heroic, just a touch. This is me. My journey starts when after I give birth to my kids, my son George and my daughter Dora. This is right after George is born. I'm nursing him. I'm wearing a boppy. My husband Craig is standing next to me. Those are my parents, and I got to draw myself as the Venus on the shell. This is my dragon. It's a computer inside a dragon's mouth. My journey basically has to do with the fact that after I had my kids, I was a writer and I couldn't write. I couldn't write anything. I wasn't writing. And so my dragon is represented by the computer. This is my crone, my mentor, helper. This is my Grammy Mill. She gave me a journal with which to write down all my stories, which is what I did when I was having my kids and raising them. I was writing all my stories down that happened. This is me in my departure phase with my friends, Delia, Lynn, and Leia. And we're setting out to go have our adventures. There's always a period of disorientation in the beginning of a hero's journey because you have to go through the threshold. You don't know what this new world is all about. And then I go into my road of trials. That's my dragon. I'm battling it. I'm not gonna do a spoiler and ruin it for you and tell you what happens. But I do go on a series of trials that include dealing with a lice outbreak, trying to find a bathing suit that fits my enormous butt, and renovating our falling apart Victorian house, things like that. Here I am getting really humble right before my darkest moment. My children are jumping on my back. This actually happened in CVS. And like I said, I'm not gonna spoil it for you, but there is, you know, it is a hero's journey. There is a transformation that occurs and a resurrection. My resurrection has to do with buying a miracle bra at Macy's. There's George in the back of my car. My sports car looks like a bra. Everyone loves my new physique. So that's my hero's journey. I'm not going to tell you much more about it, but... and here I am at the end of my journey. I had some really bad helmet head. Everything always turns out good in the end, doesn't it? That's it.
Thank Thank you. That was so wonderful. I'm definitely buying her book. Thank you, Deborah, too, for coming up with this idea. I'm fascinated by the subject myself of the stories that we make our own stories from. And thanks to the Maine Festival of the Book and Sarah and Kelly and the others put it together. Now, I'm happy to be here representing some of the modern-day fables or myths or whatever you want to call them that some of us have become addicted to. I refer to celebrities, particularly a class of celebrities, celebrities in disgrace, which I've kind of become an accidental expert on over the last, 10 years or so of my writing. And first I'm going to be talking a little about those kinds of stories and why they grip us so much, or at least some of us, and then using an example of my own biggest, longest-running obsession, which is this obsession I have with Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan, who I wrote about in a way in this, the first time I wrote about them, which was nearer to, 15 years ago, they've had, 15 years stretched into, their 15 minutes have been stretched into 15 years. And I wrote about them in this novella, Celebrities in Disgrace, which is being made into this little film right now. And then I found what I felt was the perfect, form to tell their story, or it felt right to me, which was opera and then rock opera. So I've done both an opera and a rock opera about them, which is crazy. And I also now am running this blog called Celebrities in Disgrace, which these film guys got me started on, but I wanted to plug the blog, celebritiesanddisgrace.wordpress.com, and also tie it to this whole idea of the kinds of stories that are coming from obsessions with celebrities. Like, a lot of people, come on the blog, and I have some wonderful writers come on, guest post about their various celebrity obsessions. And let me just throw this out just to see if anyone wants to be brave, like in an AA meeting or something, but are there any scandals that you guys are particularly following, you find yourself following with special interest? Sandra Bullock, yes, yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. That one is one. I can tell, and we all can tell, but they go viral right away. Yeah, that is a perfect example. Yeah, which other ones are people following? Tiger out there right now. Yeah, he's up on our blog, the Postmistress Masters Tiger Wood, and yeah, he's out there right now. John Edwards, totally. Yeah, yeah. I have very strong feelings about Mr. Edwards. I have a number of posts about him on my blog. But yeah, those ones that, yeah, any other ones? Those are good ones. Hope Benedict. Oh, Pope Benedict, the Pope, yes, exactly. Pope Benedict may not know it, but he made our blog also, because I did a post on the art of apology, public apology. Everyone's issuing a public apology. All Tiger's mistresses are issuing public apologies. Have you noticed this? And Pope Benedict, I mentioned him up there. Yeah, yeah. Any other ones? Elliot Spitzer, right, right. And poor, what was her beautiful name? She had a wonderful name, the wife standing at his shoulder. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Cedra or something. Yeah. So anyway, those are excellent examples. And Sandra Bullock, I think, is one that's right now just rocketing up. I mean, the combination, you were talking about the hero's journey, and in a way it's the anti-hero's journey with disgraced celebrities, is we are obsessed in America right now with a certain story, just like you were outlining, coming from obscurity, rising to fame and acclaim, falling into disgrace, being reborn. That is just endlessly repeating, in variations. And poor Sandra, and Sandra Bullock, here it comes, one minute she's at the height of, the world, standing at the Oscar podium, and then literally the next week. And I tell you, I was on the cutting edge of noticing the Oscar curse. I had that up on my blog. I was like, wait a minute, Kate Winslet just got divorced. The minute they win an Oscar, I wrote a post, win an Oscar, lose a husband, with about Sandra Bullock thing. But she, I think the stories that actually get that extra energy going. I feel like Sandra Bullock represents a certain kind of woman to a lot of women, and that some of her issues are very common issues, like waiting a long time for marriage and hoping that this was Mr. Right and then being deceived, and the whole issue of having children, and I'm just extemporizing, I don't know anything about her real situation, but bonding with his children and so on. So that one ties in with some of our issues. Because I feel like these things become like our folk tales or our myths, our shared narratives. It's the stories everyone knows. And my experience, running around and plugging the well, being, I don't know what you'd call it, but being involved in the opera and the rock opera and constantly talking to people over the last 6 years, like about Tanya and Nancy. And I know even 15 years later, there are strong, strong feelings about that story, which I see on a personal basis. And I also see from the, our little shows have drawn an incredible amount of media attention, because that's one of those mythic stories. You know, the bad girl, the good girl. You know, these people become these larger-than-life figures that may have nothing to do with what they really are. But a couple things that triggered me, like as a writer, to go into these stories. I was in an event a while ago, before I had done the Tanya Nancy stuff, where we were asked to bring and read something we were ashamed of liking to read, which was really interesting. And so I was like, oh, well, I have to bring, like, I brought People magazine or something. And it was a reading, like, we were set up for a reading. And I read a story about Brangelina, about Brad and Angelina. And people were just, like, spellbound. They loved hearing this, you know, in a reading setting. And afterwards, there was a lot of intense discussion. And another of the writers involved, Steve Alden, and I started talking about, you know, the seriousness with which people's emotions are engaged. Like, Steve at that time was obsessed with Tom Cruise and felt that Tom Cruise was acting out a midlife crisis that he, Steve, sort of felt. And, you know, the seriousness of that. And that's something I try to tap into on my blog. I really encourage people to write about, you know, levels of feeling or emotion or, you know, events in their own life that have been tied into their celebrity obsessions. And we've gotten some really interesting writing, I think, on the blog. And I also feel like certain people connect to certain scandals. Like, I'll mention, embarrass my friend Gail Donovan, author Gail Donovan, and I admire Gail because she's actually not that caught up in the celebrity life, but she was obsessed with OJ back when OJ was on. Like, they watched that every night. I feel like everyone has their one. My one right now that is just a work in progress is Bristol Palin, because, you know, from the beginning of the Sarah Palin saga, it was Bristol who caught my eye when she was kind of paraded out on stage with everyone. She had the giant baby blanket hiding her pregnant belly. She had a sweet Madonna kind of face, but with the sadness to it. And I started really wanting to imagine what it was like for her, you know, her side of that story. And that's why I've been writing about a kind of version of her. And to me, that's a way into that story where she's the sympathetic, person being carried along by it. But with Tanya and Nancy, something that triggered me to write about them was a remark made by the commentator George Will, the conservative commentator, during the scandal itself. And that was one of the first 24/7 kind of scandals that we had, where, you know, there was an insane amount of coverage. And he said, he was criticizing the amount of coverage, which, you know, I can see, but he said, this is an absurd story that has nothing whatsoever to do with life in America today. And, you know, I thought, well, an absurd story. Yes, of course, it's an absurd story, but it has everything to do with life in America, or it did to me, and even more so now, in a way, the sense of the insane competition and, you know, the violence lurking just under the sort of sparkly surface of things. And so there were a lot of elements of American life that kind of caught fire to me in this story. So as I said, I first started writing about it as a novella. Like, I tried to take these figures, Tanya and Nancy, and in the novella, they're kind of background figures the people are watching on TV. And I thought I'd give you just a tiny, quick example of how, you know, this character, I have Daniel Sanders, who's kind of an obsessive celebrity watcher. He's obsessed with celebrities in disgrace. He's kind of watching Tanya Harding do her famous skate-off and in the Olympics when she broke her ice laces, you may remember, or some of you are old enough to remember. And so he's kind of watching her and thinking some of the same thoughts, you know, that I was thinking watching her. Because during that scandal, I was taking notes. I just knew that I wanted to write about it somehow. So I'll just read you a little page of that. Tanya Harding pressed her palms against the cinder block wall as if braced for a police frisk. She's backstage, you know. Kneeling, her hapless blonde coach fussed with her skate laces. You ever notice, Daniel Sanders went on, sinking into a TV trance that was for once shared, how beating is like this huge theme in Tanya Harding's life? How her monster mom beat her with her hairbrush if she'd lose her skate meets? How Tanya always talks about wanting to beat Nancy? Whip her butt, Catherine added, quoting Tanya, looking almost as pale and grim as Tanya herself, who was at last taking the ice again. Tanya Harding with her aggressive red slashes of rouge and her skimpy clenched mouth, her tragically unflattering purple sequin skirt. Tanya is the only one in gold skates, the nasal sports commentator pointed out. The soundtrack music from Jurassic Park thundered forth. Daniel felt Catherine Byrne beside him hold her breath, rooting for Tanya the loser now too. Steps out of her triple loop, the commentator noted with snippy satisfaction, as Tanya on screen began to pick up velocity, nailing her next lutz, a heavy shower of ice chips. Now there's a part to play, Daniel told Catherine Byrne as Tanya flashed her feral grin. Her strong pony legs propelled her around the rink faster and harder than Nancy. Catherine nodded. Tanya hurtled into her final leap. Nice position on her death drop spin, the commentator conceded. The Lillehammer crowd burst into sympathetically heightened applause, making the most of their moment. Tanya Harding threw kisses at the crowd. They threw limp bouquets at her. So I, you know, that struck me, and, you know, I wrote the novella in which they're kind of background figures, and there's a story that kind of reflects their story unfolds. But then years later, I got a chance, because my niece was a composer and was looking for someone to do a libretto for an opera, and she wanted me to come up with an idea for it. And to me, it made perfect sense. I was suddenly like, we'll do Tanya and Nancy, you know, as an opera. And we did. We did it. And the Zero Aero Theater, which is part of the American Repertory Theater in Harvard Square, and got an absolutely insane amount of coverage for it. It was a little half-hour chamber opera. And I used some of Tanya and Nancy's own words as parts of the lyrics. And it was so it was fun for me as a writer. I felt like I was having weights cut off my arms and legs to be able to just write, you know, and to work with music and write just, you know, action and dialogue and everything. And so that then morphed into this new rock opera that we have, which is a 90-minute show where it has rock music. And we performed that recently in Portland, Oregon, which is the hometown of Tanya, and Tanya herself did come to the show. Incredible but true. I know. My life has gotten so surreal, I tell you. And so suddenly, you know, I'm this, you know, there I was in a bar partying with Tanya Harding. I mean, she is nothing if not someone who seizes opportunities. And I think she saw the show as an opportunity. And we, you know, the way I try to approach these stories is to kind of take a sympathetic, fairly sympathetic to both girls and what they went through. Tanya had a lot of violence in her life, you know, that kind of led up to what happened. But, you know, and keep the intensity and the darkness of it. It's definitely kind of a dark comedy, but also get at kind of what they were going through. And I try to do that with the Bristol Palin. And, you know, I think that's my preferred method. But anyway, she was a good sport, had a great sense of humor. We saw the best side of her, definitely, and came to the show. And, you know, I'll give you a quick sample of some of her real words that we used in the rock opera. But anyway, she went out with us afterwards, played video poker all night. And I think, oh, the most surreal moment I want to tell you, because it's like about these clashing stories, is in real life, Tanya Harding had famously asked if Nancy Kerrigan would, she wanted to give Nancy a hug, she said, during the scandal. Of course, Nancy wanted nothing to do with that. And poor Nancy, you know, has gone through so much recently. But in our show, we had a lovely girl playing Nancy. And when Tanya Harding came up to her at the end, she hugged her and then said to the audience, I finally got my hug. So there was this strange, you know, real, surreal, it was interesting. And some of the things that I used with Tanya, is, do you guys remember what she became after the skating? A boxer, exactly. Yeah. She is now a boxer. And I wish I had thought to bring visuals, because your visuals were so wonderful, and we had, you know, them in the boxing, her in her boxing uniform. So I'll just close with some of the lines that were her actual quotes about boxing that we used in the show as lyrics, just to give you a sense of this. We had her in her gloves, in her skating outfit, and she said, and I apologize in advance, the language is Tanya's, so there's a little bad language in it. Tanya raises her gloved fists in triumph and looks for anyone else to hit. Music for the song, the balls to get punched in the face. Tanya, the biggest difference between figure skating and boxing is you have to have the balls to get punched in the face. Tanya jumps down from the platform, waving her boxing gloved hands. Tanya, I broke my nose twice. First time it went that way, second time put it back right. She throws punches, mock boxing. My brains are scrambled, but not that much. My brains are scrambled. In the ring, everything comes out. I let it all bust out. Everything that's been bottled up, all the hate in me. I want to whip his butt so bad, my ex, Galuli. I want to pound him. I want to pound him. I want to pound him. The difference between skating and boxing is you have to have the balls to punch the other girl in the face. The difference is you don't get in trouble for hitting her, for hitting her, for hitting her.
And that's Tanya.
A little less, maybe. I want to start with a long personal anecdote and a brief summary of a book of the Bible, which will wind around and relate to the topic of this panel eventually. I'm Jewish, but I'm a pretty secular Jew, so I've struggled a lot with how to introduce my son, who is now 10, to religion. Several years ago, I decided I'd bring him to a Purim party at Temple Beth El, which is actually just down the road, conservative synagogue. If you're Jewish, even if you're super secular like me, you know about Purim. It's a holiday centered around the book of Esther from the Old Testament. Purim is something like the Jewish Halloween. It's a really fun holiday where people dress up in costume, eat pastries, make a lot of noise, drink alcohol. Actually, people drink too much alcohol, since according to the Talmud, which is the classic rabbinic commentary on the Old Testament, on Purim, one should drink till one can't tell the villain in the book of Esther from the hero. This is what you're supposed to do in the synagogue during the celebration. And in fact, actually, a friend of mine was saying that she had been to Eitz Chaim, which is one of the synagogues in town. She said people were, and Purim, which was just a few weeks ago, and she said people were really wasted. And I was laughing because most, what I know from my own youth is you sort of pretend you're going to drink a lot, but you know, you hold a bottle of whiskey and you go, ha, 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 put it down and never touch it again. But I guess they were really keeping to the letter of the law up at Eitz Chaim. Anyway, also on Purim, the rabbi reads the whole book of Esther out loud. It's called the Megillah, actually, and so you read the whole Megillah. It's not that long, the book of Esther, and every time the villain's name is pronounced during the reading, people go nuts. They stamp their feet, they rotate noisemakers, and otherwise cause a commotion. In 2003, on the day that my son and I went to our synagogue's relatively chaste services, our rabbi wore a giant clown's costume, and once, after she read the villain's name, she jumped around and waggled her outsized clown's fanny at the gathered, who, being largely of the under 10 set, were rarely in their seats as the story unfolded. In fact, actually, the synagogue was a madhouse, which is exactly what it was supposed to be. Anyway, as for the book of Esther, on which the holiday is based, I decided to read it in preparation for taking my son to synagogue. I hadn't read it in a while, so I sat down and read it, and I got a nasty surprise. The end of the story was not at all as I remembered it, not at all. So let me give you an overview of the tale, since I'm assuming most of you don't know it. It's much more known to Jews than to Christians, although it's in the Old Testament for both of us. Esther takes place in the ancient Persian kingdom of King Ahasuerus, and it starts during a drinking party that the king throws to demonstrate his tremendous wealth. Wanting to show off even further, the king asks his queen, Vashti, to come to his drinking party wearing her crown. She refuses. The king is enraged by her noncompliance, and his advisors suggest that he get rid of Vashti, since her behavior sets a bad example for men and women throughout the kingdom. What if all wives similarly refused their husband? A side note, in later interpretations of the story, the rabbi said that the reason that Vashti refused to appear before the king and his drunk friends was that he'd asked her to appear wearing her crown and nothing else. It doesn't say so in the actual Bible. This was the later interpretation. So anyway, back to the story. The king does as his advisors instruct. He dumps wife number one, and then he goes searching for a new queen. Virgins from the land are gathered up, among them Esther, a young Jewish orphan who's been raised by her cousin Mordecai, himself an official in the palace. The king ends up picking Esther to be his queen. She's the most lovely of all the women. And Mordecai, presumably aware of the general climate of the kingdom, warns her not to tell King Ahasuerus that she's Jewish. Esther, who's a good girl, does exactly as he says. So meanwhile, there's a second plot that's going on. Mordecai has managed to get on the bad side of Haman, who is another palace official, though he's a higher up. And the reason Mordecai is in trouble with Haman is that Mordecai refuses to bow down before Haman, although technically he's supposed to. In the sort of hierarchy of the palace, Haman's here, Mordecai is here, Mordecai should bow down. There's never explanation of why he doesn't bow down. I think you're supposed to assume it's a religious thing. He only bows down for God. At any rate, this failure so irritates Haman that he vows to kill Mordecai. And because Mordecai is a Jew, all the Jews to boot. This guy doesn't bow down. Get rid of him. Get rid of all of his people. So he's a bit of a rage monster. In order to do as he wishes, Haman manages to convince King Ahasuerus that there is a group in his kingdom who obey different laws than the law of the land, a group that he must eradicate, and King Ahasuerus, ever the lazy buffoon, easy to anger, and dependent on his advisors for making each and every decision, agrees to sign an edict for genocide without even learning who this group is. In the contemporary cartoon VeggieTales, the role of Ahasuerus is played by a big dumb pickle, the role of Esther by a shy, pliant scallion, lest children have any trouble distinguishing good and evil in the story. Okay, with the edict signed, the fate of the Jews is in Esther's hand. She must convince her husband to save the Jews. Timidly at first, and then with considerable guile, she does so by holding one, then another dinner party at which Haman is a guest. Finally, at the second dinner party, she reveals her identity as a Jew, begs her husband to save her people. Troubled, the king steps outside, perhaps to think about things. She says, you know, save me, save my people. He doesn't respond right away. He goes out into the garden. This leaves Esther alone with Haman. Haman throws himself on the bed upon which Esther is sitting and asks for mercy. The king returns, assumes that Haman is making a pass at his wife, and orders Haman hung on the very gallows that Haman had prepared to hang Mordecai the Jew. So there are a few twists to that tale with which most Jews would also be familiar, but in essence, that's the plot of the story. And it's a story such as I knew it from my girlhood to 2003 when I reread it in preparation for taking my son to services. But there's more, and I confess the more shocked me. Even though Haman gets his just desserts in the story, the harm to the Jews is not over. Back when Haman was still plotting evil, he cast a lot, pur means lot in Hebrew, to determine an auspicious date for genocide. Because a king's edict, once issued, cannot be revoked, the people of Ahasuerus' kingdom may still kill Jews on the date that Haman originally picked for death. It doesn't matter that Haman himself is dead. Now, why an edict cannot be reversed, no one says. Still, these are the terms of the story. And it's also true in the book of Daniel. There's also a similar reference to the irrevocability of a decree. Anyway, the king's only recourse is to send out a subsequent edict allowing the Jews to take up arms against their attackers, as if they would have failed to defend themselves without permission. But sometimes the Book of Esther is a little short on logic. When the day planned for the genocide comes, the Jews go out and kill those who would have presumably killed them, including the 10 sons of Haman. When the day is done, Esther asks for an extra day to continue the fighting and for permission to hang Haman's 10 sons upon the gallows. Why she wants to hang men who are already dead is another question. But perhaps this is Esther's grisly equivalent of putting heads on stakes outside the gates to London, a deterrent to further aggression. Permission is granted, given the king, who clearly likes to see himself as a generous fellow, offers Esther what she wants even before she asks it for it. On the second day of fighting, the Jews kill 75,000 men, but the Bible account assures us they did not lay hands on the spoil, this being evidence of how honorably they behave. They aren't fighting for gain. So somehow this coda to the story had escaped my attention until 2003. Indeed, I didn't know that anyone save for Haman died in the story. I certainly didn't know that Haman's sons were off for having a nasty daddy, nor the tens of thousands died. I didn't know that for years I'd essentially been having a party, going to Purim carnivals or dressing up or searching out a Jewish bakery for special Purim pastries to celebrate mass killing. This did not sit well with me. It wouldn't sit well with me no matter what, but it made me particularly uncomfortable because I happened to reread the Book of Esther on the eve of America's entry into Iraq. Like a lot of people, I imagine, I had no problem when our country went after the Taliban in the wake of 9/11, but I disapproved of the decision to go into Iraq. It seemed to me that we were victims on 9/11, but in 2003 we were being victimizers. And I thought the same thing about the Jews in Esther. They were victims, but by story's end, they seemed to be victimizers. I don't like to be an American when Americans do bad things, and I really don't like to be a Jew when Jews do bad things. It makes me uncomfortable. It makes me squirm. And I think that things that make you uncomfortable and make you squirm are the very things that you should look at in art. So I decided to write a novel that is very loosely retold the story of the Book of Esther. And the end result was this novel of mine that came out last fall, and it's called Good for the Jews. So that's the story of what inspired me to retell an old story for my novel. But it's not quite the end of what I have to say. I think you almost always start with one idea for a novel, but then the novel you write is another thing. In the process of writing, you discover other concerns. Even though I wanted to look at how victims became victimizers in my novel, I went a little off track. In part, this is because the Book of Esther isn't just a story about anti-Semitism. It's a great story about male-female relations and about palace intrigue. I saw how I could easily translate that into a story of contemporary romantic relationships and of office intrigue. Rather than have a kingdom, I chose to have a school system with a superintendent, a high school principal, and a history teacher as my characters. And rather than two queens, I decided to have two wives. I also hoped that some of the bawdiness and silliness of the Book of Esther got translated into my novel as funny or sexy material. And I suppose it did to a degree, because one of the reviews of the novel called it a sex-drenched book, a comment about which I've gotten no shortage of grief. There isn't that much sex in the book. In the end, of course, I was trying to steal some of the power of the old story from my own work, so really what all of us have talked about today. There's a reason that the Book of Esther is much beloved by people. It's a great story, and though I couldn't count on the fact that I'd do a good job of retelling the story, I could count on the fact that the bare bones of my novel would have some merit. So one final thing. I wondered if I should tell people that the story was a retelling of the Book of Esther. The fact serves as a bit of a spoiler, and I didn't want to ruin my novel's plot for people. But I could never come up with a succinct way of describing my novel when people asked for it. So I started saying what I've already said here, that it's a loose retelling of the Book of Esther. If I had been able to come up with a better summary of my book, though, I think it would have been better not to tell. Better to be a literary cat burglar, to basically steal the ideas of God, or talented ancients, or whomever you think wrote the Bible without announcing the theft at large. But if I did that, then I couldn't have come to talk to you today. So thanks for having me here today. It feels like my reward for criminal behavior. Idea was that we take questions, but we're sort of at the end of our time. So, Sarah, are you here?
I think you can do
like 10 minutes?
Ten minutes.
Okay, why don't we do 10 minutes of questions, and Nicole and Elizabeth will join me up here, and then we'll finish off in 10 minutes.
Ahead.
Oh, yeah, well, Nicole, you would talk about heroes, journeys, and mothers, and I thought of one while you were talking.
Oh, good.
It might sound kind of silly, but I know that in the show Xena, she goes through the hero's journey as well. And she actually, in a season-long story, becomes the victim of Athena, who is angry about her partners because that she's becoming a mother and doesn't want her to have this child because she views it as a threat. So I thought that would be something that you would find interesting.
Oh, yeah. Is she a mother when she's not a mother when she starts the journey? But
The series, actually, she has two children throughout the series. So that's something that I think that you might find interesting.
So that's Xena. It's the
Warrior Princess.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. I owe you some money. You see me afterward.
Not much. The other question I had for you when you would talk about like the hero's journey is often thought about as regards to Jesus.
Yeah, I haven't actually thought a lot about it. I really don't, this sounds really ignorant, but I really don't know that much about Mary. Can you talk a little bit about it? What your ideas are?
Well, I was thinking, you know, she, in the beginning, she follows the hero's journey because she is living like a regular life when she's visited by an angel who gives her, you know, basically the initiation that she's going to be departing from this regular life and become someone very great. And, you know, they have the flight from Egypt from Herod, who's after trying to kill the children. And I would say, like, her revelation, too, would be the same one as Jesus, where she's present at his death. Early in her life, at least the Bible says that a prophet tells her that she's going to, her child will be great, but she'll also feel like a sword has pierced her soul, which is supposed to be to the crucifixion, the resurrection. So I hadn't thought of it until you were up there saying it, but you know, her life seems to have a lot of elements of the hero's journey in
right.
it.
Right, parallels. Yeah, that's something definitely I want to learn more about, and thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
I'm interested.
That's a good question. Yeah, definitely. I mean, with the Tanya and Nancy stuff, as I mentioned briefly, that, you know, when that story was unfolding, I knew I was going to write about it in some way. It just gripped me so much. And so I was taking a lot of notes on it, you know, as it happened. And then the different versions of it that I've done, because the novella is its own story that kind of reflects that story. Yeah, it does. It takes you, you know, you can sense, you know, when you're a writer, it's like a divining rod or something. Something is just charged to you. And that was just charged to me. It had a lot of elements, you know, girls and girls fighting girls and competition and ambition and violence and, you know, things like that. So there were a lot of themes that interested me. And both times that I did it, the novella and then this, the opera and the rock opera were different. And then now this film thing too, which involves them. It's always a different take on it. It's interesting. So yeah, but I feel like for those in the crowd, I know there's always a lot of people who are writing or interested in writing. Something I urge my students from this experience is, if something interests you, no matter how oddball it is, you know, kind of follow that. I mean, like, I just knew that was, you know, there was something in that for me. And when I finally got to tell it on stage, I felt like now I've really explored all the things in that that were interesting to me. And so, you know, even if it's something crazy, I know somebody, a filmmaker who just made a film about dental flaws. And all the different, and honestly, it's a well-acclaimed film. You know, it's been used as an escape mechanism in prison, all sorts of things. And he just followed this oddball interest, and, you know, so it was charged material to me. You want to speak on that one or not?
Oh, definitely. I think when I started writing the book, I didn't know how it would end. And it became kind of metafictional because while I was writing, I sold the book. So I then got to give it a happy ending because the book is about writing a book. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know whether I would sell it or not when I started writing it. So then I'm like, oh, that's how I can end it. I can sell the book. It's a happy ending. Yeah. Thank you.
This podcast from the 2010 Maine Festival of the Book, an annual festival organized by Maine Reads, is brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council.